Well, good morning once again. Just a couple things to make you aware of and update you on in the life of our body. I pass on thanks from Pastor Greg for your prayers for him and for his family. He is home now and out of the hospital and eating and resting, and he's still very weak and probably looking at still several days or a week or more for full recovery, but we're grateful that God has brought him this far and just ask you to continue to pray for him. Secondly, there is a memorial service this afternoon for Leota Barrett here in this room at 3 o'clock. You're all invited, an opportunity for us to come together as a church family and remember her life, be an encouragement to Reed and to the kids. And to our extended family. There'll be people certainly in attendance today that do not know the Lord as their Savior. And I would just ask you to pray, whether you can come or not, to pray that God would be glorified in it, that His gospel would be clear, and it'd be an opportunity for the truth of Jesus as the only way, the truth and the life, to sound forth in this place to people that may not normally have the opportunity to hear. So that's this afternoon. I will forever... This is going to be an odd thing to say, probably, but forever associate Columbus Day, not with Christopher Columbus, but with missions trips at the Master's College. It was always the case that every year we would go out on a fall missions trip, and it seemed to always fall on or around Columbus Day. Part of the reason that's so probably ingrained in my mind is one year we went to a Navajo Indian reservation, and they didn't do a lot of celebrating on Columbus Day. There was a big poster board in the hallway that said Columbus Day, celebrating 500 years of tourism. And so it's ingrained in my mind. But I say that to say we have a group from the Master's College this week that I've not even had the chance to meet yet, and I'm sorry for that. But would you just stand so I can recognize you and thank you? You recognize some of them. I want to thank you for coming. The claps you heard the loudest were probably from those parents whose junior hires you watched at the lock-in. They've been here since Wednesday and really giving up several days of what could have just been fun in Southern California to serve our church. They've been working in the children's ministries. They've been doing stuff around campus, working with youth ministries. And we really do thank you for your ministry to us. And we're glad you're here to worship with us this morning. Well, I encourage, if you would, to take your Bibles and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Just want to commend you all for coming back this week after Ecclesiastes chapter 1 had this just horrible vision of a whole week of men sitting in the chair on the couch not going to work, saying it's all vanity anyway, and kids not going to school, and lawns overgrowing and no one got haircuts this week, and laundry and dishes was just piling up because it's all vanity anyway. And then I come to church and I'm alone this morning because why bother? So thank you for coming back after Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We're reminded in Ecclesiastes 1 of the reality of life lived under the sun. That's key, and we'll look at that phrase again this morning. It's in our text again, that life under the sun, without God, the perspective from humanity without God is meaningless. That it is boring, it is transient, it is marked by monotony and insignificance, and we live life desiring things that never satisfy us, longing and going after things that never appease us. And it is a charge from an old man, the preacher, to a younger generation, to a young man, saying, don't go down these paths. I've gone down the path of success and it has failed. It's been vanity. I've gone down the path of financial freedom and it has been vanity. I've gone down the path of sensual pleasure and it has been vanity. Don't go down these paths. And I thought, as I reflected on the perspective that we gave to Ecclesiastes last week, I thought it might be possible for you to sit in here this week and say, but what about me? What about the old person? This is a charge to the young person not to go down these paths. What does this have for me, the old person? Now, who's old in here? If you're offended by that, I'm talking to you. If being called old is offensive, then it's you I'm talking to. there's responsibility in this for you as well. To look at the things that you have done in your life, both for the good and for the ill, the mistakes you've made, the paths you've gone down that verify the experience of the preacher. And then to say to the next generation in this room, the people around you, don't make the mistakes I've made. Don't go down the paths I've gone down. Too often, we have generations that experience these things and learn these things and have all the wisdom of experience. And instead of passing that on, just sit back and mock the next generation for doing the same thing. We need you to stand up and say, listen to what I have learned. Listen to what experience has taught me. So we come to chapter 2, and the questions that are before us are questions that get to the heart of what our greatest desires are. Let me ask you this morning, what is it that you want? What do you really want? What is it that you think will make you happy? What thing is it in your life that you are chasing? As a man, as a woman, as couples, as families, what are you chasing after? And then when you think of the answer to that, think back 5 or 10 years and think, have I accomplished those things that 10 years ago I set out, this would make me happy. If I had this, I'd be happy. And now you have it. But I think if we're honest, what we've done when we set goals that are simply under the sun, that have disregard for the things of God, that we just keep making new lists. We just have to keep thinking of something else, because as we attain those things, we find out there's no meaning in this, that it is in fact vanity. And we come to this book that was written some 3,000 years ago, and yet it's remarkably relevant for our day. It's like reading of a journal of someone who's writing in our context, saying that life is empty if you attempt to live it under the sun. And what he does, beginning in chapter 2, after summarizing this endeavor in chapter 1, is he begins to set himself up as somewhat of an expert by way of experience. Saying, I have walked down various paths, and I'm going to recount for you those paths. And I want you to see and learn from the mistakes that I have made. And as he recounts the journey of walking down each of these streets, he asks the question, does this satisfy? Does this bring joy? Is there meaning here? There's a sense that the preacher, Koheleth here, is saying, I'm looking for the path of joy. I'm looking for the path of meaning. And so I'm going to set out on a great experiment of path after path after path to see if this path brings joy, if this path brings meaning and purpose to life. In chapter 2, he heads down the path of secular hedonism. He heads down the path of pleasure and asks, is this the path? The world has said that if you pursue these pleasures, if you satisfy self, then in fact you will find meaning and purpose in life. And he heads down the path of pleasure in chapter 2. Starting in verse 1, he says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched my heart, how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Well, as he did in chapter 1, he begins with his conclusion and speaks of unquenched thirst. It's a miserable feeling, isn't it, to be thirsty and not be able to drink, to be thirsty and not be satisfied. And this is what he speaks of in verses 1 and 2. I say to my heart, come now. It's a transition. He's turning now to pleasure from the wisdom he spoke of in chapter 1. I told my heart, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to test you with pleasure. I'm going to deliberately set out and choose to experiment with the pleasures of this world and see if maybe that's where satisfaction can be found. I'm going to take all of my time and all of my energy and all of my resources to explore pleasure. Now, this is an important note because the preacher had unlimited resources. He had unlimited resources. Nothing was a barrier to him getting what he wanted to be satisfied and to seek satisfaction. See, we're unable to do this, and this is the power of Ecclesiastes. We're unable to devote all of our time and all of our energy and unlimited resources to just getting what we want. And so there's this sense in us that, well, if I could get that, then I would be happy. And so he's taking the perspective of someone that has attained it all, someone that had no boundaries to what he could gain. And he said, let me tell you where it led us. I'd set my heart to be tested with pleasure. Now, pleasure in and of itself, and this is important for us to note as we go through the book of Ecclesiastes, pleasure is not sinful. It's described in a number of places, even in this book, as a gift from God. It is not that pleasure is sin. It's that pleasure as an end, pleasure treated as the ultimate good without God, is meaningless, is vanity. I think there's a perspective, certainly you've encountered it, you have conversations with non-believers about coming to Christ in the gospel, and their perspective of Christianity is it's just boring. It's just full of boring people. Oh yeah, you're those people that can't do things, right? Or you have to do things. You can't do this, and you have to do this, and life's just boring. Scripture presents exactly the opposite. Life is full of pleasures that God intends for us to enjoy. In fact, the very pleasures that are put before us this morning in chapter 2 are ones that are adulterated by sin, but in fact are pleasures that God intends for His children to enjoy. Then he says, I pursued laughter. Laughter's not bad. Laughter's good. I hope. Do you like to laugh? I like to laugh. But he says, in the end, it's madness. He pursues pleasure. And the use of the words here that are translated laughter and pleasure for us are words that picture kind of both ends of the spectrum, both kind of the party scene and the refined pleasure scene. And we looked at it last week. He's pursued both of those ends. He's gone to the underground rave and he still threw up in the morning. He's gone to the Academy Awards party and he still threw up in the morning. And the sense is I've tried both ends of the spectrum and both end up in the same place. Both end up in misery. Both are madness. Both are folly. Both are useless. Laughter is foolishness. It's not bad. It's just not ultimate. And it's almost as if he anticipates, as he moves from his conclusion in 1 and 2, that this pursuit of pleasure is vanity, he anticipates the human objection. Yeah, you say you pursued pleasure, but did you go far enough? Did you really give yourself fully to it? Did you find enough pleasure to really say that it's vanity? Did you try hard enough in this pursuit to really come to the conclusion that it's all vanity? I think so often in life, many, maybe some in this room, when we encounter emptiness on the path we're on, the sense is not that there's something wrong with the path, but just that we haven't gone far enough. That maybe around that next corner, maybe around the next bend, if I just keep going far enough, then I'll find what truly satisfies. I'd encourage you, look around. Read books, read biographies. Has anyone ever gone down this road of hedonistic, secular pleasure and discovered happiness? Spend some time watching the Biography Channel. Spend some time watching and reading about people that have given themselves to this pursuit. There was a show, I don't even know if it's still on. I remember years ago someone put me onto it called Behind the Music. And it was biographies of bands. And these groups and these musicians that they lived the life. They had everything that they wanted. And every single story was just misery. So often we believe, I just haven't gone far enough. I just haven't done enough. There's pleasure around the next corner. And the preacher says, let me tell you, in anticipation of that objection, let me speak and convince my audience that I have indeed gone as far as one can go. I've exhausted the trip down the road of pleasure and it has led to vanity. And he begins in verses 3 all the way through verse 10 to speak of unsatisfied pursuits. He says in verse 3, he starts with really what we might call partying. I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. He went after wine. He looked for meaning in a bottle. He devoted himself to the bar. He said, okay, laughter doesn't do it. Maybe they're having fun at the bar. They're telling me it's fun down there, and so I'm going to go down there. And in our society, certainly we have other things, other avenues to pursue in this vein. This is the promise of drugs. This is the promise of alcohol, that happiness is found here. Happiness is found somehow. Meaning is found. Purpose is found in this bottle, in this capsule. Some might say, well, he didn't go far enough. He didn't know, go to the right clubs. He didn't have big enough parties. If it was a big enough party, let me tell you, the kinds of parties that are described for us are ones where tens of thousands of people would show up. Hundreds of animals would be slaughtered. People would party day after day after day with unlimited resources to do whatever they wanted. He said it was all vanity. It's nothing more than a temporary anesthetic that numbs the pain of life and the futile effort to find meaning under the sun. Then he says this, and it's an important phrase. He says, my heart still guiding me with wisdom. He's going to say this again. If you look down at verse 9, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. See, the point of that phrase is to say this, that in the midst of this, he never lost sight of the experiment. He never lost sight of the goal. He went into this pursuit of pleasure with the desire to find out meaning and purpose in life. And as he walks through each of these doors and down each of these paths, he never loses sight of the fact his wisdom never leaves him. His discernment never leaves him to step back from each of these paths and evaluate. In the midst of the partying, in the midst of seeking for significance in a bottle, asking, is there anything here? Is there any meaning here? Is there any truly lasting happiness here? And wisdom stays with him through this entire process. Well, he partied, but not only did he, once realizing the emptiness of this, he abandons that and decides to work hard. Does that sound like a typical path? He's speaking of a journey that's not uncommon to many, maybe in this room, to many in our day, that they experience those college years, those young years where it's just live for self and live for Friday night and go out and party and just abandon all responsibility. And then night after night of that just being miserable and hopeless and meaningless, you finally wake up one day and you go, okay, this isn't going to do it. I need to get a job because that's where I'm going to find meaning and that's where I'm going to find purpose. And so he moves from the party scene in verse 3 to projects in verses 4 to 6. I made great works, he says. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. Notice the repetition of this phrase, for myself. I made myself. I did this for myself. Time and time again. Whatever pleased him, he did. His house, his gardens. We think this way, don't we? Sometimes we think, well, the next thing, the next project will satisfy me. The next phase will satisfy me. Once I move out of the house, you know, then I'll be happy. I'll get out on my own. That'll make me happy. That'll make your parents happy, right? We get out and I'll have, and then you think, well, this is just renting and that's not really satisfaction. But once I own my own house, then I'll be satisfied. Now, here's a man who has unlimited resources and says, I built multiple houses. If I wanted a new house, I built it. He had a summer house and a winter house and a spring house and he had all fall house, I suppose. Houses that met whatever need he wanted. Houses in foreign countries. Houses for vacations. Houses for his wives. Houses for his children. I've seen people like this. I can think of a person that I know that just constantly works on their home finding meaning. They're constantly... They can't stop and think about life or they're miserable. And so they just keep working. They keep adding on. They keep building. They keep manufacturing a place that will give them peace, that will give them satisfaction. He doesn't stop there. He says, I made myself gardens and parks. I planted them in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. Do any of you find satisfaction in gardening? Maybe that's your hobby. I like gardens. I don't like gardening, right? I like them as a noun, not a verb. I like to go and enjoy gardens. But there is something, and we're going to see this here. He didn't plant a couple of geraniums. Okay, he didn't go out back and plant a row of daisies and then stand back and say, hey, look what I did. Now, there's satisfaction in that, is there not? To accomplish something and to work in the ground and to plant something. He planted gardens, and the word is a word where we get the word paradise. He created Eden. He created gardens that, I mean, make Huntington look like square foot gardening, right? Only three of you are going to get that, but it's insignificant. He stands back and looks at it. And it brings nothing but hopelessness. There's nothing there. He moves then from projects to possessions in verse 7 and 8. I bought male and female slaves. And I had slaves who were born in my house. My slaves had slaves. Right? I'd ask a slave to do something, he'd pass it on to his slaves. I mean, I had slaves that were established and there were slaves that born to them in my house, full of slaves, hundreds of slaves, probably thousands of slaves. It's a picture of someone who does nothing for themselves, who has no need to do anything for themselves. He's built an empire. Now he's just going to sit back and enjoy it. And so he hires for him people to just meet every need. He wakes up in the morning and his private chef does breakfast. And then he goes to massage number one, right? Before having a light brunch from a different chef. Before he moves to massage number two. Before someone carries him to his rooftop. Just to look upon all of his possessions and his garden and his forest that he's planted. And these pools that he's planted. Just to water the forest that he's built. He had possessions of herds and flocks. A picture of wealth during that time. I love pets. I mean, one of the downsides of pets is you've got to take care of them, right? I mean, he had all the joy of all the animals you can imagine and all of the creatures that he could surround himself with, and he did none of the work. If he wanted to pet the dog came when he pet the dog, but he never had to follow the dog around with a plastic bag. Somebody else did that for him. He enjoyed the dog, never had to brush it. He enjoyed the horses, but he didn't have to stable them. If he wanted to ride, he snapped his fingers. And the picture is just of extravagance, that whatever he wanted, he had the enjoyment of all of these things. He could slaughter hundreds of deer, of cows at a time to feed his guests at these parties without worry that it would hinder his or affect his bottom line, his wealth. It says he also gathered for himself silver and gold, not just property, but cash. He got singers, it says in verse 8. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings. I got singers, both men and women. Now, they didn't live in a time with portable music. Right? They didn't have MP3 players. You wanted to hear live music, you went to a concert. And so here's this man. Where the conversation, if you can imagine, someone comes up to you and say, hey, did you hear so-and-so's new CD? Yeah, I bought them. Oh, you bought the CD? No, I bought the band. That's the picture. He's like, hey, I like U2's latest album. I'm going to buy Bono, and I'm going to put him in a room in one of my houses, and when I want him to play, I just snap my fingers, and he comes out and plays. Yo-Yo Ma's next to my, if I can't sleep at night, I just, Yo-Yo, come over, right? And then he comes over this cello and he plays. That's literally the picture. He's surrounded by his favorite musicians at his every whim. If you like music, can you imagine that? Can you imagine? You say, yeah. Oh, man, that would be satisfying. Get the MP3 player. I've got all these bands that I own. They belong to me. They sing for me. They meet my needs. They play whatever song I want whenever I want it. As many concubines, he says, the delight of the children of men. I want to be sensitive here to the fact that there are young ones in the room, but there was no sensual pleasure or desire in his life that was unfulfilled. There was nothing that went unsatisfied. He wanted something, he had it. He had fame, verse 9. I became great and I surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. He was popular. He was great. He was a man that people wanted to be around, man that people wanted to spend time with. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. Just in case you can think of something that's not in the list after you have all the houses and all the possessions and all the cash and all the land and all the gardens and all the pools and all the animals and all the music and all the pleasures that you can imagine. He says, let me just be clear here. If I wanted it, I got it. I denied myself nothing. Now, I think if you're honest this morning, there's many of you thinking, I'd be willing to give that a try. You're thinking, I could be a little happy demanding everything I want, walking into a store and saying, yeah, I'll take that. Yeah, I think I want to move. I'm going to move. I'm not going to move. I'm just going to buy that house. I don't like moving. I'm just going to put new furniture. Not happy with this girlfriend, I'll have 5, I'll have 10, I'll have 100. Not happy with this wife, I'll have 5, I'll have 10, I'll have 100. Anything you desire. People all the time doing what you want, serving you, meeting your every need. Never having to lift a finger, never having to do work. There's something, is there not, in our humanness that says, I'll try it for a little while. Surely that'd make me a little bit happy. And if I can come back to it, can I ask you to be honest in the evaluation when you think about those things that are your goals, that are things that you're headed towards? How many of them are connected to these kinds of things? Oh, you say, I never have expectation of having thousands of slaves, but are you not really giving yourself to pursuing a direction that you get what you want when you want it? And that'll bring happiness. He says he's partied. He has gone after property. He's gone after possessions. And he comes to verse 10. He says, I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. It begins this conclusion. And the preacher here is standing at the entrance to this path of secular pleasure. And he's saying, I know you're thinking about going down this road. I'm telling you, I have been all the way to the end, and I am begging you, don't even start down the path. Now, he gives an important and honest note here. And I want you to hear this well in verse 10. He says, my heart found pleasure in my toil. I appreciate that because I think we might discount his advice if he says, and it was all misery the whole time. We'd say, come on, I'm giving myself to amass wealth and I kind of like it. I like sitting back at the end of a hard day's work and looking back at what I've accomplished and saying, yeah, that felt good. I like pursuing these things. You say, I've been to the parties and I got to tell you, they're kind of fun. And that's precisely what he's saying. There is a measure of pleasure in these pursuits. There is joy in the work. There's a measure of joy in the experience, but it never truly satisfied me. I never felt full. I never felt whole. And this is why the path of hedonism, the path of pleasure, is appealing, because there is a measure of joy. And Satan tells you, oh, didn't that taste good? Didn't that feel good? Did you feel yourself just beginning to be satisfied? Yeah, you say, but it wasn't wholly satisfied. You go, oh, that's because you haven't gone far enough. Just take one more step. And you take one more step. You say, well, that was good, but I'm still not satisfied. Oh, you haven't gone far enough. Take another step. And another, and another, and another. And now we have the journal of a man who says, I have gone as far down that road as one can go. There is no pleasure known to man that I have denied myself. And my conclusion? There's temporary joy. There's joy in the moment, but there was nothing like the fullness of joy. And he steps back in verse 11. The picture is of having gone down this road, of surveying all that's been done, and asking where it has brought him. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity, and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. He comes to the same conclusion. Having given myself fully to the pursuit of these things, I discovered it was all vanity. It was all a striving after wind. I was chasing my own tail. I was pursuing something already in my possession. I came up empty-handed time and time again. And the picture of striving after the wind is such a powerful one. Because you think of how wind passes by you and it brings pleasure. It brings joy. And you think, oh, I'd like to feel that all the time. I think I'll put some of this in a cup. I'll catch some of this. I'll hold on to some of this. And it can't be held on to. It's fleeting. It's moving. It's passing. There's joy. There's pleasure. There's, oh, that's nice. I want more of that. And then it's gone. And it can't be held on to. There's something that I think is profound about this text. I want to make a note first to those that are young in this room. I'll let you put yourself in these categories. Who maybe are in the front end of their life, they're on the front end of their career, you're on the front end of these pursuits. And there's part of you that says, I at least got to try it. I got to give it a go. And I would urge you, it is not just the preacher that stands at the entrance of every one of those roads, but Christ, who says, you can head down a road that does not satisfy, I will satisfy you. You're going to pursue things that will bring emptiness and vanity to your life. Please don't go down the road. You think that, no, partying is the answer, and being with the right crowd and at the right club and in the right scene and being part of the right group, that's the answer. That somehow it's found in this abandonment of responsibility and just the pursuit of whatever I want. But I think there's a note here, and I'm going to make this specifically to fathers because I think it's probably more of a male mistake than a female, but if you're a female and this applies to you, consider this to you as well. When I speak to the young and I say, yeah, the path of the party scene and the pleasure scene and the doing whatever you want, the dads go, that's right. Like, that's right, son. You listening to this, right? And maybe even say, I've been there and it's worthless. And then what's our answer, dads? You need to get a job. Right? You think satisfaction's found in just living for yourself and living for Friday night? No, satisfaction's found in responsibility, and satisfaction is found in work, and satisfaction is in you getting a job and working hard and making something of yourself. Is it not tempting to think like that? And I just imagine that maybe there's some of those kids that are pursuing the party scene and they're listening to you, dads, as you say, hey, you're going down a stupid road, and they're saying, you're not happy. That's what you do, Dad. You go to work every day. You live for work. You live to get the next thing. You live, yeah, we have a vacation home. Yeah, we have this stuff, but you're miserable. Why would I want to go down that path? And see, Solomon says, whatever path you choose, whether it be the path of the young and the abandonment of responsibility, or the one who goes down the path of responsibility and hard work, if you pursue those things without God, they are both worthless. They're both meaningless. And so, fathers, may we model for those that are young, not someone who's committed to work as an end, but work to the glory of God. Not work that we might amass wealth, but work because it brings honor to God. Work for the provision of a family, to care for them, to love for them, to please our Father in the way that we serve others. Our work is a means of expanding the kingdom of God. Our work is an opportunity to share the gospel in places that pastors don't have the opportunity to go. Opportunities to have wealth, not that we might amass stuff for ourselves, but use it for the kingdom. And then tell our children to go down that path. And then he comes back to this phrase that is the great qualifier of the book. It is all striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained. What's the next three words? Under the sun. If this is all there is, then it's meaningless. If all there is what I can see and feel and touch and experience, then this is meaningless. C.S. Lewis wrote of this in a book called Present Concerns. And it's an extended quote, but I think it's a helpful one. He says, let us begin by supposing that nature is all that exists. Let's begin by supposing that all there is what's under the sun. Let us suppose that nothing has ever existed or ever will exist except this meaningless play of atoms in space and time, that by a series of a hundredth of chances, it has, regrettably, produced things like ourselves, conscious beings who now know that our own consciousness is an accidental result of the whole meaningless process, and it is therefore meaningless, though to us, alas, it feels significant. In this situation, he speculates, I think there are two things one might do. One might commit suicide. He expounds that and he says, secondly, you might decide simply to have as good a time as possible. The universe is a universe of nonsense, but since you're here, grab what you can. Unfortunately, however, there is on these terms so very little left to be grabbed. Only the coarsest sensual pleasures. You can't, except in the lowest animal sense, be in love with a girl if you know and keep remembering that all the beauties of both her person and her character are a momentary and accidental pattern produced by the collision of atoms, and that your response to them is only a sort of psychic phosphorescence arising from the behavior of your genes. That's a downer, right, on your first date. Like, you cannot go on getting serious pleasure from music if you know and remember that its air of significance is a pure illusion. That you like it only because your nervous system is irrationally conditioned to like it. You may still, in the lowest sense, have a good time, but just insofar as it becomes very good, just insofar as it ever threatens to push you on from cold sensuality to real warmth and enthusiasm and joy, so far you will be forced to feel the hopeless disharmony between your emotions and the universe in which you really live. All of your life, he speaks to the, the plight of the preacher in Ecclesiastes to the plight of man, there is an unattainable ecstasy just beyond the grasp of consciousness. Oft on the verge of breaking through, yet we never have it. All things that have deeply possessed you have been hints of it, tantalizing glimpses not quite fulfilled, echoes that died away just as they caught your ear. This is the secret significance of each soul. It is the incommunicable and unappeasable want. It's the thing that we want before we met our wives, developed our friendships, and chose our work, and which we still desire when we are on our deathbeds and our mind is no longer knowing wife or friend or work. Books or music in which we thought it was located will betray us if we trust in them. It was not in them. It only comes through them. If they are mistaken for the thing themselves, they turn to dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. For they are not the thing, only the scent of the flower we have not found, echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have not visited, music we are born remembering. I read it in its entirety because I think he so well captures the heart of what Ecclesiastes 2 is about. And I think, frankly, the path that so many of us can find ourselves on. Hints of things that satisfy, but they never really do. Longings for things that we think needs will be met in the things of this world, but they're never really met. Now, please hear this. The problem is not pleasure. God has given us nature. Victor referenced it this morning, to fully enjoy. He's given us projects. He esteems projects in Scripture. The Spirit empowers workmen to do a day's labor. He is going to speak in Ecclesiastes that the joy we feel in work can be felt, a sense of satisfaction, a sense of a job well done, as a gift from our Maker. Think parties. Was that God's idea? It was. He demanded that all of Israel set aside a tenth of their salary just to party. It was commanded. We're going to have feast and we're going to eat and we're going to laugh and just be together. And you got to set aside a part of your income just to do it. It was God's idea. Corporate worship. Relationships. Again, being sensitive to the audience in regard to these matters. But think about the garden for a second. Now, we have adulterated sensuality, but God had a good idea, right? He made them think about what state they were in and said, go enjoy it. That's what he told them to do. It was God's idea. We have messed it up. God is a God that brings and offers pleasure. But the problem comes when we make those pleasures ultimate. And they become idols that disappoint, as Lewis says, the heart of their worshipers because they are not God. And we seek those pleasures and seek to enjoy those pleasures from the perspective of someone who is under the sun and there is no satisfaction, there is no meaning. Our thirsts are not quenched and our pursuits are not satisfied. But let's not close there this morning. Because there's some good news. Matt read for us from John 4 earlier in the service. A woman comes to a well and Jesus is sitting there. And he asks for a drink. And she's shocked by this because she's someone who's an outcast to society. She's coming at a time of day where no one might see her, not the normal course of things. Jesus is aware something is going on in this woman's life. And he says, would you give me a drink? And she does. But the conversation turns, is it not? And Jesus ends up offering her water. And she's saying, water? You had to ask me for water. Now, how is it that you're offering me water? And he says, if you knew what I had to offer, if you knew the water that I could offer you, then you would drink of it and never thirst again. In Isaiah chapter 55, Isaiah gives a similar picture. He says, you spend your money for that which is not bread and your labor for that which does not satisfy. you go after things that promise satisfaction and it never comes. It's good for a moment, but it's fleeting. You spend your resources and your time and your energy on labors and buying things that you think will satisfy you and give you peace and give you meaning and give you purpose, but it never does. And listen to the words of Isaiah, the backdrop even of John 4 and Ecclesiastes 2. The Lord says this, come. Come. Everyone who thirsts, come. Come to the waters. He who has no money, come. Come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord. Come to the Lord, that he may have compassion on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. He beckons us to come. And he's saying, from your limited perspective under the sun, you pursue these things, thinking there's satisfaction, thinking there's pleasure, thinking there's enjoyment, and it's fleeting. My ways are not like your ways. My thoughts are far above your thoughts. As high as the heavens are above the seas, my thoughts are above your thoughts. And I'm telling you, come to me, and I will give you water that will fill you up, will quench your thirst, give you pursuits that will satisfy you. So what do you do with this? I think sometimes it's easy, maybe in a text that tends towards more the philosophical approach to life, to walk away and have really good discussions, but not to know what to do with it. Can I encourage you to do with this text what the author does in verse 11? To stand back and survey your life. To be honest about what it is that you're headed towards, what it is that you're working toward, what it is that you're pursuing to satisfy you, where it is that you're seeking to find pleasure. And search your soul and be honest enough to answer that question truly. And be honest enough to come to the same conclusion that the preacher does. Because you will. You say, yeah, there's no satisfaction in this pursuit. I'm living for myself. I'm living for my paycheck. I'm living to amass wealth. I'm going down a road seeking pleasure, and it really is not satisfying. And then come to the one who pardons freely and who will satisfy your thirst and pursue those things, not for themselves, but in the context that we don't have to live. The context of just being under the sun, but the context of all the universe and a God who is above all of it, living for him, living to please him, remembering your creators, as he will say in the end, fearing the Lord and walking in his commandments. Can I ask you to bow your heads?